So, very good afternoon, everyone. Good evening. And Philip tells me this is also on web stream. So, wherever you are, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. And I think this is one of those times when we really appreciate the modern technology through which one can send out greetings to friends across the world, East and the West and the Far West. And it's a wonderful opportunity to be here after all these years of seeing pictures, of course, the wonderful calendar that everybody is aware of. You know, personally, having seen so many pictures of this wonderful temple, Guru Rinpoche in the Lotus Lake, and the enormous amount of great activities that has been happening through the generous compassion and wisdom of Sojal Rinpoche, as well as the Sangha of Rigpa around the world. And so it's with great anticipation and great joyfulness that I'm finally able to make a visit here at Lerabling and to coincide it with another very good event, I think, the Buddhism and Medicine event that is to take place over this weekend over here. So I think it's excellent. The weather is just very fine in this region, as it can be, and among good friends and many people who have been extremely kind. So it gives me a lot of happiness to be with you this evening. So all of us, you know, in the East have always been greatly inspired over many years hearing, reading, and familiarizing ourselves with the activities of the Sangha of Rigpa. And I know that many of us have taken great inspiration in following your example of what is fast becoming known as the westernization of Buddhism. And so it is a very, I believe, interesting time that we are all living in. This generation and the next will probably be playing very important roles in the flourishing and further spreading and strengthening of Buddhist teachings in the various countries other than the Eastern countries where Buddhism has originated and been taught over many hundreds of years. I say it is a very interesting time because these are the times where following the works of great masters who have taught and planted the seed of Buddha Dharma is now being listened to and practiced by generations of people. Not only the young, intelligent generation, but now the Buddhist generation that has come of age, where it belongs to senior citizens, young people, teenagers, and children who are born to parents and therefore are brought up in a culture of Buddhist teachings. And so their sort of contact with Buddha Dharma isn't really what it used to be in the early 60s, 70s, and then even in the 80s. So since it has now become a complete, much more contained atmosphere of practices and teachings of the Buddhist teachings, it becomes interesting because it is at a crucial stage where it is no longer a seed that has been planted. It is no longer new. But it has become very much a deepened connection for many, many people. And so it is interesting also because it is at that very crucial juncture where you cannot simply associate yourself from a theoretical basis, from an intellectual basis, but becomes very important to actually now engage and experience the teachings as a practitioner. In the earlier stages, I believe it was quite okay for people to have certain curiosity about Buddhist teachings. And I know many of you who are fairly new to Buddhism may still be at that stage, and you're allowed to be at that stage. But whom I am talking to mainly at this point are people who've been Buddhist for several years now, who've been Buddhist for 5 years, 10 years, 15. Some of you have been Buddhist for 40 years, 45 years now. And so for that generation of people, it no longer is good for one, especially if you find the Buddhist teachings to be making sense, that it is something that is good to practice, has meaning in your life, and you consider it to be useful for yourself in cultivating good qualities, then it no longer should retain that intellectual approach based on interest or some kind of half-hearted approach, but should be brought about to a stage of maturity where one begins to think based on the foundations and the teachings and the views that are taught in the Buddhist teachings. And so when that kind of intimate connection, when that kind of deepened and very wholehearted connection with the Dharma has to be cultivated, then it depends upon not only the studies and listening to the Buddhist teachings, but to also integrate that to your life, daily life, and to deepen within oneself a sense of discipline regarding meditation and practice, where you have to experience that in meditation, where you have to experience it deep enough to make it pervasive in all aspects of your living. When that needs to be done, then it also calls for very intensive practices. And so personally, for me, what has been very inspiring and what I've been very curious also to find out more about is the retreats that you've had over here in the past, the extended three-year retreat that every one of us were deeply struck and inspired by. And for me personally, more than the 3 years and the actual three-year retreatants, the urban retreats that were introduced by people and a discipline of, I believe, 4 hours of practice that many people, some of my good friends, were engaged in, I thought that took westernization of Buddhism steps forward, where this particular thing that I'm talking about is not only having an intellectual connection with Buddha Dharma, but to integrate it seriously in your life and therefore not only being what I think and what I call loyal Buddhists. You know, there's the loyalists who like the idea of Buddhism, and then there are the practicing Buddhists who are actually engaged in the practice of Buddhism, and there's a demarcation between that. And I really felt people were practicing Dharma. People were actually engaging and devoting their life to a profound view that hopefully will allow themselves to really bring about to the forefront and make useful, bring about useful results for oneself and the others as the teachings teach within this lifetime. So prior to saying anything, I really wanted to mention my deepened gratitude to Sujai Rinpoche and everyone who made that possible. And I hope that it is something that continues to happen into the future that I think will be the key factor of really strengthening Buddha Dharma into not only becoming a popular topic of discussion, but it will be something that we live by and experience. And that, for that matter, one would not have to give talks on a subject such as compassion versus competition. Now, because if you look at the topic that you've given me to speak about this evening, and I don't know whether this is Philip's idea, but technically, I think such a topic should never exist. If one is compassionate, one shouldn't be competitive. And if one is totally competitive, I wonder if that person would have genuine compassion. It's a very, if you look at it, it's kind of a very paradox situation. However, many of you are practicing Buddhists. You've tried to practice compassion. I've tried to practice Buddhism, and I've tried to practice compassion. And so it's a direct first-hand experience that we are all living witnesses that there is such a thing as compassion versus competition, isn't it? All kinds of spiritual practices in the world, all different religions that have evolved through the different civilizations of the world, have in their own distinct ways taught philosophies and teachings, ways through which a human being can generate best of the qualities. Now, without speaking about other religions, But since we are talking about Buddhist view of compassion, let's stick to Buddhism alone. Buddhist teachings teach the path through which one may cultivate best qualities, best potentials of human beings, through which one may be able to genuinely bring forth the resultant state of happiness for oneself and the others. In simple words, Buddhist path, if someone says, what does it teach? What does it believe in? Then one can say, Buddhist path believes that there is a possibility to obtaining freedom from suffering of self and the others through eliminating the causes that bring about suffering for self and others. That's the gist of what Buddhist meditation is all about. Now, having said that, and most of us who have lived with the Buddhist teachings, we all understand that this is what we aspire to do so. But the problem that comes about is, as most masters have talked about, the enormous discrepancy or the non-supporting factor between intent and action. So it's common for all of us to know that we all aspire freedom from suffering. Nobody wants suffering. That we all aspire happiness. This is what the Buddhist teachings commonly, generally teach us. And as practicing Buddhists, this is something that we all believe in. And so many times I have said, if you look at the number of literature that is available in all religions, and then if we don't talk about other religions, just in Buddhism alone, most of us Buddhists have a collection of books that our bookshelves can no longer hold. Each of those books, if you open, say the same thing in different ways. How to be kind, how to be selfless. But on the other hand, you and I exert quite a good amount of effort in trying to achieve that. If somebody asks us a direct question, do you believe you should be kind? What would your answer be? If somebody said, is compassion a good quality to cultivate or is it a bad quality to cultivate? What would our answers be? If somebody said, do you exert effort in cultivating kindness, loving kindness? Of course we do. But despite that, and despite all this, our years of engagement with the path of the practices, our deepened devotions extended towards the three jewels, the three roots, our teachers, despite the many different kinds of responsibilities of daily life, especially for the Western practitioners, family responsibilities, job responsibilities, financial responsibilities, despite all of this, you still make time for retreats, for practice. You travel the world to receive teachings. Despite the fact that your marriages are on the verge of divorce, you insist on having a meditation cushion and a shrine in your homes. Isn't it? Now, all of these factors show the level of dedication that we have in trying to cultivate this quality that the Buddha Dharma teaches, emphasizes. But then, again, individually and as a general group of practitioners, all of us have the similar experiences. At some degree, there is still a discrepancy between intent and action. Our love, our dedication, our devotion, our meditation, our practices and our teachings somehow seem to be so much more connected to the level of the mind and the intellectual mind. In the level of intent, in the level of hope, in the level of wanting, in the level of aspirations. And yet when it comes to actualizing them wholeheartedly, wholesomely, in our actions of body, speech, and mind, we do experience a gap. That is called the non-supporting factor between intent and action, where intent doesn't support action, where action is not supporting the intent. And so where that gap happens, then we live in a very schizophrenic kind of a situation. It's almost a dual personality syndrome that we all suffer from. And so what happens is this immense longing to cultivating those qualities, and some of us break down in tears. We ask for divinations to be done on what obstacles could be removed so that we could practice better, isn't it? But with that sincerity of want, of really wanting, is there, it is crucial for meditators to begin to see what is it that still is lacking, which doesn't allow that aspiration and that intention to be completed within the actions of the body, speech, and mind. And so I believe when we all struggle with that, then such a topic such as compassion versus competition does happen. As I said earlier, based upon all the wonderful teachings of the different philosophies and religions around the world, each one of them have this wonderful capacity of imparting the best of the teachings for the progress and betterment of human qualities. Likewise, I think Buddhist practitioners, again, are wonderful people. Now, I'm not sure how many of you have the experience of living in a community. I believe many of you live here, so you have this experience of living in a community. I have lived my whole life in a Buddhist community. By virtue of that, I would say that individually, if we talk about people living in a community, everybody has, of course, good points and bad sides to the story. But on the other hand, comparatively, if you look at a generalized comparison, I do sincerely believe that those who are practitioners, not necessarily Buddhism, but because we are among Buddhists, I would say Buddhist practitioners, that they are some of the most wonderful people living in this world. That every little bit of sanity that still is there, every harmony that the world is able to experience, and that each day passes into the next day peacefully and we're able to continue the civilization, I think is the result that this world still enjoys numerous and a vast population of genuinely good people, genuinely kind people, people who love peace, people who love harmony, people who are kind and compassionate and understand the importance of expressions of love towards one another. Now, however, if you look at that sense of goodness, basic goodness, that is present, that is prevalent in the world, at the same time, now if you go individually, and that's why I mentioned living in a community. So as a community, for example, another example would be, as I look at you today, a room full of Buddhists, there couldn't be a much more beautiful picture in the world than this. Beautiful temple with beautiful people who are all trying to understand and cultivate compassion. Nothing can get better than that. Now, why I did mention living in a community is now when we go person to person, and those of us then who have lived in communities and when we get to know each other well, that is where we then find a lot more work to be done, isn't it? So just as there are layers of this wonderful artist, artifacts, thangkas and paintings, then there's, you know, beyond that, there is the wall that is painted very beautifully. Beyond that, there is the concrete. Beyond that, there's the bricks, then the iron bars, and different kinds of materials that have gone into construction. So there are layers to what is apparent, and in the same way, human nature has layers. And so in those layers of an individual person, there are many different areas that still require tremendous amount of work. Now, if the Buddhist teachings and the methods of practices that you are doing are not able to cross into all the different layers intrinsic of an individual, and you are simply marveling the exterior presentation of what it is, then just as you would spend 15 minutes in this wonderful shrine and say how beautiful things are, in the same way you could also say how wonderful the Buddhist community is. Isn't it? But that's not how it is. Buddhist teachings have never emphasized appearance. What is very crucial to understand is you're either a Buddhist or you're not a Buddhist, as we say. There are no other ways. There's no third way. A Buddhist is one who doesn't place so much importance on the appearance of what is. It requires the honest approach of self-examination. And as long as that self-examination is not cultivated by each individual, as a group singing songs of how wonderful the idea of compassion is will never actually be strong enough to bridge the gap between intent and action. That's a major problem that each individual meditator needs to understand. One of the reasons why I believe that despite, now coming from a Buddhist, it may always sound like a propaganda, but nevertheless, I think it's also very true, is that the profoundness and the absolute truth of the Buddhist teachings is, you know, there for all of us to actually experience. However, despite such an honest and such a profound view, there is also the very situation where Buddhism is very few in numbers. I've often thought about it. When we Buddhists talk about great big gathering, we talk in hundreds, isn't it? When the Catholics talk about great gatherings, they talk about millions. Now, in terms of just numbers, there is a smallness. And sometimes I wonder why that is so. And over years, I've felt that Buddhism actually is not a very popular teaching at all. It is popular to a certain degree where it satisfies the intellectual mind looking for something that is glitzy. But after a while, when the glitziness of the Dharma fades and then you begin to find out a lot more has to be done about yourself, it's not about belonging to a group. It's not about feeling good for a moment or for a weekend. There are certainly no Christmases to celebrate, isn't it? And then there is, I believe, no Adam and Eve to blame for the original sin, isn't it? And it all falls on the individual self, then the whole, you know, beauty of Buddhism falls down to it becoming a very practical approach of working with your own self. And that's not a popular thing to do. This human being is so used to quick things, fast food, internet, cell phones, all the quick things, shortcuts. And when our whole culture is so very attuned to that, talking about lifetimes of working very hard on your own self, watching everything you say, watching everything you do, watching everything you think, is an extremely difficult and a challenging path of practice. And so what happens is the mind begins to refuse. But somehow, you're also a loyalist. You're very loyal by now to your teacher. You've taken refuge, you can't go back, you've taken those empowerments. You know, on the other hand, this heart, this mind that tells you this is important to do. You cannot deny impermanence, isn't it? Cause and effect is very relevant and easy, logical to see. Preciousness of what a human being can achieve is very much there. And most importantly, you're gifted with a sympathetic heart that wishes to alleviate the sufferings of self and the others. Now, when those natural good qualities and the intrinsic basic wisdom that every individual is endowed with allows you to also not fully give up Dharma, but on the other hand, you don't want to be that wholeheartedly a Buddhist too. You know, in the beginning you thought it would take only weekends. So when that sort of clashes with you, then we feel this immense struggle within our own selves. And I think this is the bulk of the generation, population of Buddhist practitioners. There are those who have traversed the path honestly and have achieved bodhisattvahood, become Buddhas, have benefited sentient beings. On the other hand, then there are those who have never heard about the Dharma, who are ignorant of the fact that there is such a thing as the Buddhist path. And then there's this big population of people like you and I, who are there, neither on this side, neither on that side, but in an odd situation, uncomfortable situation, where we would like to be compassionate in a competitive way. So what do we do? I have been thinking about, you know, what can we do? My personal experience, as I've always said, goes back into, I've, you know, talked about this incident so many times in my different talks, so some of you may be familiar, but this is the first time I'm here in Rigpa, so it's pretty much a fresh example for many of you. But I often think about how I grew up myself. I grew up in a monastery, and besides my mother and my sister, I was the other only woman growing up among about 500 men, monks, Tibetan monks. And so, you know, you grow up with a sense of having to always do good, especially when somewhere at the back there are people who tell you you have to sort of raise the flags for women in Buddhism, or that the previous was so-and-so, and the lineage requires you to do so-and-so. So you, I think, psychologically develop a kind of a stubbornness in your attitude. And I grew up as a teenager as a very stubborn, angry, you know, very uptight kind of a young person. I still continue to be so. Many people tell me, whenever I tell the story, afterwards they say, you haven't changed much. So, so that also is one thing. But that being my nature, then sometime in 1987 and in the 90s, and then of course continuing on, I began to continually come to the West and give teachings. And then began to relate, and as you come back every year, you begin to know more and more people. So in the beginning, when all of you are good Buddhists, after a few years, you find out they're not such good Buddhists. You know, everybody has a story. Nobody does what you tell them to do. Every year you teach them, they hear you, and then they don't do what you tell them to do, and then come back with more problems. So each year, there began to become a pattern. And this was the time when my root teacher, my father, was still alive. And so the pattern was that I would travel for about 4 to 6 months every year. And then when I went back home, the first thing I did always was to complain to my teachers about the Western students, isn't it? And so they don't do that. They don't have devotion. They don't dedicate their whole life to the Dharma practices and so on and so forth. So for the first time when I did it, His Holiness listened to me. He was very sympathetic. Second time I did the same thing, he was also very, you know, listened to me, very sympathetic. Third time, fourth time. But when you do this every year, you know, around the eighth or the ninth time that I would come back after a long tour and then complain about the Western students, one day, before even I had a chance to say much, he stopped me. He stopped me and he said to me, you know, you don't like those people, do you? I find that moment to be a very big moment of change, personally for me, because it really stopped me on my tracks into actually seeing. It was a very straightforward question. Do you like them? Don't you like them? And if you didn't like them, nobody forced me to go back every year, isn't it? And if you liked them, then you have to like them completely with their good points and with their difficult sides to it. And so ever since that, I've always kept that as the most changing moment in my life. And somehow since then, I've really begun to like the Westerners. I do. And it has in some ways relaxed one important thing, and that is my expectations. And when your expectations are relaxed, it makes the working situation so much more easier. There is much more joyfulness, there's a lot more playfulness, there's ability to meet another person more as a human being, not as someone who talks down to somebody else or somebody who has to listen to somebody else. I believe the very key factor from this, what I have learned myself, and which could be helpful to many of you, is that you can never really learn about Buddhism or try to practice compassion without actually liking each other. Some of us really think that we can practice compassion without liking somebody else. Think about it for a while. We really do. We think I can be kind and compassionate almost from a perspective of being in a marooned island with nobody around you. That's why we long to go into retreats, so that somewhere in the 22nd century we can then become compassionate bodhisattvas. Right now, you would not mind not seeing another Buddhist for a long time. Isn't it? There are those little sort of situations that we develop, concepts that we develop in our own mind that needs to be thoroughly examined. And for that, it is crucial to take the honest approach of looking at your own self. We all suffer from that. We all suffer basically because this compassion that we are so very much hoping to cultivate, we all think there is an exception in one's own case where certain things are there that we could be excused from not doing. That there are, of course, all the previous ones, and then those who are coming into the future would have to engage in Dharma completely. But in my case, in my personal case, maybe an exception can be found. An exception where I can eliminate a few neuroses without having to transform them or transcend them. Exceptions of not including few number of people. And an exception that I can achieve the same by thinking hard about that theory, by being very loyal to that view, to the extent that I'm going to write the view as a calligraphy and hang it on the wall. But an exception can be made that I may not have to change myself at all. Some things I'm willing to change. I regard them as negative, and I'm willing to change slowly, but deep down, certain things that I'm unwilling to change. So what happens is the self-absorbing neuroses, self-cherishing, and the self's agenda of holding its own self to be important is left untouched. Somehow, psychologically, we have, as in many other situations in the mundane world, we develop a psychological ability of denial. Denial of a problem in relationship, denial of a disease that we may be suffering from, denial of a habitual pattern that we may have that is harmful to self and the others. In the same way, the same ability of denial, of changing the self, and especially the neurotic tendencies of the self, become something that we give in to. And the appearance of a Dharma practitioner thereby gains more momentum and strength. And this is then where we begin to hide behind the religiosity of Buddhism and become more loyalists to the Buddhist view rather than actually bringing about this whole practical approach that the Buddha taught about finding the path of eliminating the causes that our body, speech, and mind creates, that itself becomes the cause of suffering or happiness of other sentient beings. The whole path of compassion taught in Buddhism isn't about simply doing something that sounds very lofty, beautiful, and profound and poetic. Compassion is taught as one of the most important aspects of Buddha Dharma, because if you think about it, without compassion, really getting anything out of Buddhism isn't going to happen. Of course, I've always said, compared to not doing anything, doing something is always better. Therefore, even a very half-hearted approach and a kind of a very contaminated approach of understanding, let's say compassion, may have some benefit to it. Or being a loyalist to the Buddhist Dharma may have some benefit to it. But if you look at why Buddhism is practiced, or why it is taught, and why it has held its ground of being one of the most authentic paths of practice, is not because it has laid emphasis, or sort of laid importance or emphasized the appearance of Buddhism as much as it has taught about personal responsibility that you have of creating causes and conditions that actually sort of are experienced by self and the others in our own lives. And therefore, it is crucial for the understanding of compassion that one realizes it is not an adjective to simply put on in your relationship to the Buddhist path of meditation. But it requires introspection. It requires tremendous courage, tremendous contemplation, tremendous insight into human nature, your own capabilities, and the power of causes and conditions that one creates that impacts one's lives and the lives of the others. And so, compassion, therefore, by great scholars and masters, have always been defined as that which accomplishes selflessness. So if someone says, define what compassion is, and of course, compassion is an English word. And I personally do not really see how much the word compassion actually captures the term bodhicitta, which it is closely related to. So when we say it in Tibetan, we say janchuji sem. When we say in Sanskrit, we say it bodhicitta. And then commonly today, when we try to translate that, then we say compassion. And I really don't know how much compassion, the English word, captures what bodhicitta is trying to say or what the literal definition of janchuji sem means. But without getting into that kind of a scholarly kind of a dissection of the words, let's just imagine what the word compassion can be defined as. The English word compassion could be defined from a Buddhist perspective as an accomplishment of selflessness, where a person is able to accomplish victory over self-grasping, conquer self-cherishing, able to gradually, step by step, tread on a path of contemplation, examination, introspection, building mindfulness and awareness that is able to allow the sort of shifting of the focus from self to others. When we are able to practice this, when we are able to accomplish this, this is then called being compassionate. Now, when this is not understood, when the aspect of shifting the focus from self and the self's agenda, self-centeredness to the needs and the welfares of the others, when this is not understood to be what compassion is, then we fall into the glamorous appearance of what compassion means. So we buy books which ever talks about compassion. And as soon as somebody says the word compassion, all Buddhists feel hairs of their body go up and say, well, that's a Buddhist philosophy. This is ours. Somehow we think this belongs, the word compassion belongs to us. And in that way, we try to sort of satisfy the need of actual change that has not occurred by aligning ourselves into liking the idea of compassion. But since that kind of a glamorous idea, the beautiful sort of the ideological ideas of compassion is what we are sustaining, absent of the honest approach of changing the focus from self to the others, we are never really able to give up agendas for our own self. And the agenda of the self, of course, that which originates from self-grasping mind, promotes an idea into our own mind, imagining that the compassion is just a way of achieving happiness, that the compassion is a way of avoiding suffering, that the compassion can actually give birth to the result of our hopes, that the compassion is an escape from fear, that compassion can actually be praiseworthy, and we are attracted to the praise. The compassion is a way of avoiding blame. That compassion is something to obtain. That through compassion, you can obtain something. That compassion is actually compensating for a loss for our own selves. Basically, we allow the lacking of self-introspection, the courage to changing the self-centeredness, allows us to bring in what is commonly called the eight worldly dharmas into the different aspects of our compassion. And so what happens is we do try to be compassionate without really having the courage and the insight to let go of the agenda of the self. And the agenda of the self is nothing but the eight worldly dharmas. Primarily, happiness for self, not wanting to experience suffering. And if that becomes the sole reason why you're being compassionate, you have a problem. As a meditator, what should we do is to then look carefully inwardly and see, are you associating the agenda of your happiness with the act of compassion that you are doing? For example, if you're being generous to the others, are you doing it so that in some direct and indirect way, this is going to give you happiness? This is going to alleviate the suffering. And mind you, sometimes emotionally we blackmail ourselves into thinking this is good for everybody else. This is the happiness for all the others. And this is for the alleviating of the sufferings of everybody else without ever really questioning who do you mean by everybody. And sometimes when you think carefully, you say everybody every day, and yet you have absolutely no idea who you mean by that everybody. Well, everybody means everybody. For example, I've often asked meditators to think. One of the common practices that we all share is hardly any practice is there that we do that doesn't conclude with dedications. And there are all these kinds of lovely dedications that we do. And it's always worthwhile to sit down and think, whom do you actually mean when you say, by this merit, may I defeat all sufferings of sentient beings, or by this merit, may all beings be liberated from samsara and the sufferings of samsara. You know, to take a while to think, whom do you actually mean? I'm sure some of you are very honest and you do take a while to think about all sentient beings. But speaking for myself, my whole life, until I came up with, you know, trying to think about this, I've probably spent years and years doing dedications every day of my life, after every session, without really having any idea who I meant by sentient beings. Certainly not those who I talk to. Certainly not those who I live with. Yeah. And so when I come to think about, by this merit, may all sentient beings be liberated. What do I mean by all sentient beings? I see many dots. All sentient beings. It's not my responsibility. It's the responsibility of the sentient beings to benefit from my dedication. I don't have the time to think about who you are. That's the kind of attitude we have. And therefore, where the mind itself is not even familiar with what do we mean by sentient beings, then when we talk about, well, for the benefit of all sentient beings, does it actually mean all sentient beings, or does it mean whatever is most convenient so long as you're happy at that moment, so long as you think you've accomplished an act of generosity? And therefore, of course, we want all sentient beings to be free from suffering and to have happiness, but it's not really a priority at this moment. So long as the duties of dedication, so long as the duties of tonglen, so long as the duties of your mani mantras and your dedications are there, there's a sense of showering, you know, sort of grains of rice as you fly by in an aeroplane, and hoping that the sentient beings are responsible for picking up all the grains that you have showered that will pacify them from their hunger. And with that kind of an executive class, you know, attitude, future bodhisattvas are going to probably work with just SMSing, text messaging, acts of generosity. So this elitist attitude that develops, and this has not much power in shifting the focus from self to selflessness. And so one continues to uphold the view of compassion as a great view that we Mahayanist Buddhists particularly consider to be the very epitome, the very peak of our path of practice. And yet the actual contemplation and research examination intrinsic of oneself that is required may not be done. In the same way, when we associate our own hopes and fears and the agendas of our own hopes and fears to be predominant, and we are compassionate so long as our hopes are secure, so long as our fears are completely eliminated, then we are going to be compassionate. Then that is sort of compassionate at your convenience. not wholeheartedly. And this also then does not have the power of eradicating lifetimes and lifetimes of self-cherishing, self-grasping attitude. And so we wonder that despite being, you know, somebody who really would like to generate compassion, someone who is trying very hard to practice compassion, why are we not able to actually practice compassion? Why is it so difficult? We ask ourselves that question, we ask our teachers the question, why am I not bringing about the required transformation? The required transformation is simply not taking place because we are covering up the old habits with new garments. Each time we bring in a new covering of a new teaching or a new method or a new practice or a new way of looking at things, new interpretations and new expressions of what the teachings teach, but refusing to have the courage to looking deep within one's own self, to eradicating those age-old habitual tendencies that is simply unable to shift the gears from the strong self-grasping to allowing others to be, if not more important, at least just as important as one's own self. Now, the Lojong training, because of this, becomes not only Lojong, but subsequently everything that is taught in Buddha Dharma arose out of this situation. Buddhist teachings, if one looks at it, is a very matter-of-fact teaching. It's very obvious, and therefore, in that view of it being very logical and obvious, shouldn't actually be a difficult path of practice. When it was first taught under the Bodhi tree by the Buddha himself, who realized it, and then subsequently turned the Dharma, the wheel of Dharma, and taught to the others, to a certain degree, historically, we find the simplicity of the Buddhist teachings. Taught by a person under a tree to a group of people, basically the teachings which taught about, if you want this, create the ground of it. If you do not want something, simply don't create the causes for it. Nothing can be more logical or straightforward. There's no God involved in it. There's no punishment involved in it. There is no Buddha fields to meditate. There is no offerings to be done, no prostrations to be done. No retreats, no mantras, no philosophy, no refutation of philosophies. Very straightforward. And it didn't take much, just 2,500 years, to make it into today the world's most complicated philosophy. How did we do this? Fairly easy. You just don't get to the point. You keep finding new ways each day on how you can find an exception to the rule. That's what complicates it. And actually, therefore, from that perspective, we can find that what do we do as a meditator is try to find new ways in which way we can achieve enlightenment without doing a single thing called transformation of the self. Every time you do 1,000 mantras, take a while to see what are you trying to do. Instead of getting down to the very nitty-gritty details of not creating the causes of unhappiness for yourself and the others, we're actually trying to do the opposite. Create all the causes for suffering, never want them. Never create any causes of happiness, always want them. But in the midst of it, visualize deities with hundreds of heads, recite mantras of which you have no idea what you are saying, read complicated philosophies and the refutations of those by great scholars and then refute some more. Isn't it? That's what we do. And then in the middle of it, we think, why am I not being compassionate? Why is my mind not able to let go of self-grasping? There are these strange things that we keep doing. And because of these great sort of like a bad virus that becomes immune to medicine and something new has to then be found, our tendencies of becoming immune to what is very starkly and directly logical and trying to find different ways of avoiding the medicine. Therefore, it became necessary for great masters to come up with these varieties of different meditations, different kinds of techniques or philosophies and teachings that then today is what is today called Buddha Dharma or the Buddhist teachings. All of them excellent, skillful methods, but each excellent, skillful method still completely powerless if one is not going to join that method with the courage of self-change, of being able to see and maintain the awareness and the mindfulness, of focusing upon everybody else and everybody else's needs and the well-being of everybody else, holding others to be as dear to oneself as one holds oneself for an entire lifetime. Because of that, the greater vehicle of the Mahayana teachings became the very life force of Buddhism in India, and particularly for the Tibetan Buddhist practitioners, because it is the incredible profundity of the word compassion that then began to have the one single, unique, powerful ability to tap into a resource that is natural to all human beings, and that is basic goodness. Each human being, as the Mahayana teachings say, has the inner potential of basic goodness. And basic goodness is fairly simple. That you like a quiet moment, that you appreciate beauty, that you are able to enjoy the warmth of the sun, that when you see something nice, it touches your heart. And simple things such as when you watch a nice publicity or an advertisement, you smile. When you hear something that is terribly tragic, your heart reaches out sympathetically to that situation, are all indications of a natural propensity that each human being has that associates with love, that associates with happiness. And these conditions are born out of the basic goodness, the fundamental nature that is more strongly associating itself with goodness intrinsic of one's own self. And knowing that, great scholars and masters, the enlightened beings, knowing that natural intrinsic ability to really have much more deeper connection to love, to peace, to genuine goodness, allows us a practice of training one's own mind in which ways it can shift its focus from self to the others without feeling threatened, and not feeling threatened simply because you know that that is your natural quality. It isn't something else that has to be brought in. It is your very natural quality. And so the beauty of the Mahayana teachings, particularly great teachings such as the Lojong training, is one of the most comprehensive and direct ways of really working with your own individual self with the most obvious, not something that is unknown to you, but something that is most obvious to you. And so many of you who've, through the years of being Buddhist, those of you who've studied Lojong training, you all know that the Lojong training, of all the different ways in which it is taught, primarily today what is prevalent are the 59 slogans. If you refer to the 59 slogans of these Lojong training, especially the one connected to the Atisha's slogans, you will find that there's hardly any slogan that is not something that you not naturally know. You know it naturally within your own self. But the kindness and the wisdom of the masters is in gathering all of these teachings into a systemized approach so that you have from A to Z a very sequential path of working with yourself in not learning something new, but making what you already know very clear and obvious to one's own self. Therefore, in the very beginning of training in practicing compassion through the Lojong teachings, it talks about building the basics. Now, of course, with the time that we have today, 59 slogans will be here for a long time. So if you go into the 7 points of mind training, for example, and the very first talks about building the basis of a good foundation of bodhicitta or generating compassion, which is crucial for all of us to understand. And that is why it's very important, especially for today's practitioners, to keep in mind not to run around wanting to be compassionate. So it's very easy to listen to a talk on compassion, feel suddenly very inspired, and do something that you may not be able to sustain for a very long period of time. But to be able to actually restrain yourself into going into a very basic approach, into a very practical and a basic approach to learning about yourself. And so in some ways we can say If you really want to be compassionate, start inwardly. Be able to work with yourself first before you start with the others, so that you don't do something like what our nuns do most oftentimes, and I always tease them. Our nuns, of course, living in nunneries, often are very inspired by various teachings on compassion. And the common thing that they always get into is a trouble, where after a session on compassion or Tonglen or whatever similar kind of teachings it may be, they go out to give away everything they have to the others. It's a different story that 1 week after, most of them are running around trying to get them back again. So I always tease them about those very, you know, bursts of inspirations of compassion that may not be long-lasting. So instead of outward expression of compassion, really build inside. And therefore, Lojong training spends considerable amount of time working with the first training of the mind, the first essential point, and that is called building the foundation of the compassionate heart within your own self, which begins with a thorough understanding of the four reminders, without elaborating too much on it, since most of you are familiar with that topic. But at the same time, it takes us all to a point which is most crucial, and that is, as long as you do not understand how capable and full of potential your human life is, you'll never be able to actually give to the others. If you reflect upon the preciousness of your existence, its capabilities, its rarity, its precious abilities, an inward inspiration of being content with your own potential builds a strong foundation of kindness and generosity to the others. Without having the confidence of knowing your own precious human birth endowed with all its qualities, there will always be a hunger within your own self which you will try to compensate with your spiritual practices. And that is where today, commonly, many meditators run around really lacking in what is called sort of self-deprecation, where you are lonely, where you are not appreciated, where you yourself do not appreciate yourself, where you think you are inadequate, where you think you are half full, where you think you need more, where you think there is so much of negativeness within one's own self. That kind of a hungry spirit-like attitude which one suffers from, such a mind immediately is a very poor vessel which can then think about the others. Therefore, in contemplating upon the 18 qualities of the precious human existence, and then if you don't go into all the details of the 18 qualities, just that you are lucky, you're a human being, you have so much more. And instead of looking at all that what you have not got, if you looked at how much you yourself have gotten at this point, building a confidence and a contentment as a human being capable of so many good things. If this first reminder is soundly built in one's own attitude, such a person builds a good foundation for a generous person, someone who can then possibly have more time to think about the others, feel more confident to think about the others. In the same way, impermanence, the transitoriness, the impermanence, and especially impermanence from a positive outlook, an outlook which is not seeing things always sort of as the impermanence teachings themselves talk about change, about death, about destruction. Not only about that, but in a much more positive way, and which I call diffusing an intense situation. The beauty of impermanence is that whenever situations get very intense, and since we're talking about compassion, when you really think a situation is getting so intense that you really don't feel compassionate at this moment, think about impermanence. It might be a good moment where it can diffuse and create a non-exaggerated situation of that moment. In the same way, when you think about the power of cause and effect, how powerful you are. And based upon how powerful you are, if you can actually then sense the responsibility of all the things that you have within your power that can create, break or make a situation, as they say. This also teaches a person to be a little bit more confident about one's own self and the abilities to think about the others, go a little bit beyond self-preoccupation and one's own fears, one's own hope. In the same way, where we talk about compassion for others, and yet if that mind is totally lacking in the awareness of the sufferings and the needs of the others, such a mind would, of course, very obviously have difficulty in really generating any kindness or compassion. And that is why sometimes I am very amazed at many of my Western friends who often say things like, oh, I don't watch the television because it's too tragic, or it has just too many negative things that are happening in there. I just cannot bear to watch all that bloodshed and disharmony and so forth. I can understand to a certain degree what you mean, because sometimes when you see them, you feel them. But on the other hand, when there is an obvious denial of what is the reality of this existence, then you are preserving your own awareness from being very selective about the situations. And therefore, because of that, many of us do become very elite in our approach to practicing compassion. And many times I think that today we are in a very sad situation where all the future Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the samsara are all trying to learn compassion from books and intellectual, you know, sort of ideas. I often think about myself, for example, or many of us who are in this situation where obviously, as we say, many of us have, all of us have difficulties of one another, of one thing or the other. If I ask myself, and if someone says, you have no problems, I will beg to differ. I do have problems. But compared to what really problems are, my problems are mainly, as I say, my demands not being met all the time. And therefore, a person like me, when I have to speak about, let's say, now, sufferings of the world, I'll have to read books. I'll have to read about what masters said 1,000 years ago about suffering. I'll have to memorize the different classifications of suffering that are there. And I'll have to meet with intelligent, some more intelligent Buddhists who will talk to me about the impossibilities of there being an 18-realm hell. And then we all get into an intellectual discussion about whether there are possibilities of such extreme torment and sufferings or not. And we will all go back home thinking, maybe, maybe not. And out of that kind of an intellectual approach, we are supposed to have compassion. It's never going to happen. For compassion, you have to keep all your senses very outward. You'll have to hear the saddest of the tales. You'll have to see things. You'll have to experience things. Reading, theorizing, intellectually trying to comprehend what suffering is may possibly be one of the most important factors why we don't feel compassion as urgently as it should be done. Because for you and I, we think compassion is important, but it can wait a little bit more. After this weekend is over, when something else more tragic happens, and sporadically, since we are all very lucky, we may encounter one, two, or at the most three incidences in our life that may sometimes shake us out of our ignorant state of this blissful existence. And at that time, we may encounter a moment which sparks in us an inspiration to truly be compassionate. There are very few lucky ones who allow that moment to be continued, and very many unlucky ones who feel it for a moment and again spring back into its own state of ignorance, where we think being kind is very good. Not being kind isn't a great catastrophe anyway. And so where this kind of a situation, lacking in the thorough understanding of the four reminders, are absent, such a meditator, such a Buddhist practitioner, no matter how much you want to try and practice compassion, will always have not built a strong foundation. Lojong trainings summarizes the basic foundation of generating compassion, training one's own mind to be on the foundation of the preliminaries. And the preliminaries start with the outer preliminaries of contemplation on the four reminders. So if there is any way in which way I can stress the importance of contemplating the four reminders, that is the approach that is most needed to be taken it is to be stressed, it should be stressed in your practice, and then following that into the actual preliminaries of engaging in the mantra practices. Second point of mind training is a further step of this. It no longer says try to think about it, but to try to do it. And so somewhere between compassion in thought and compassion in action, there is a trial period, so to speak, where, second point, the generation of bodhicitta, generation of compassion, is emphasized through two approaches, an absolute approach and a relative approach. Relative approach, I believe, is very crucial in that if you really want to practice compassion, do what Shantideva says. Don't go prematurely into being compassionate, but do it in the form of breath. Do it in the form of thought. Do it in the form of a simple thing such as non-judgmentally or without too much of an elaboration, allowing something from your right hand to be given to your left hand. And educate your mind in trying to understand non-exaggeration of compassion, non-exaggeration of generosity. To do it as the most natural thing, to do it in the most matter-of-fact, in the most simple of the ways. And therefore, theoretically, the Buddhist teachings teach about training the mind in giving through practices such as Tonglen meditation or through various contemplative meditations. Why is this important? Is it necessary? It is absolutely necessary. Even if you feel highly inspired to give out everything that you own, never start there. Always start in thought. Always start by simple contemplations through your breath until you come to a point where you learn what absolute bodhicitta tries to teach you. And that is, as the slogans of different kinds says, rest in the nature of illusion and so forth. But if you simplify that, what does it mean is, until you begin to know that an exaggerated situation and a non-exaggerated situation depends upon your take of it. Every time that you do something, whether it is a negative action, whether it is a positive action, always pause for a moment to know that you have a choice. You can exaggerate it into 20 years. You can exaggerate it into a lifetime. You can almost stop your life on its track. You can exaggerate it to that degree. Or you can keep it very simple and just to that moment. That's the capacity that you have. What's the point of meditating on emptiness, nature of phenomena, and self if you can't learn this very factor? Is the power of exaggeration that you are equipped with. Now, when I live my life with the monks and the nuns and the different kinds of Buddhist practitioners, lay practitioners, you know, sometimes you have to go out and scold them, as they say, if they do something wrong. So sometimes I play with this, is that before I go out to scold, I can basically decide how much time I have, you know. Is it going to be a 15-minute exaggerated state? Am I going to make the life of this person miserable for 2 years? Can I let it go easily? Do I involve two people in it? Do I involve the whole Sangha in it? Do I involve the lineage in this? Do I just keep it to a very simple thing? Or in some cases, I think, well, today is a nice day. I'm going to be humorous about it. And then there is no scolding at all on that day, isn't it? But this is an example that you can play with yourself. Is that each situation is dependent upon how you see it, how you view it. You have that absolute ability and power to make or break that situation at any moment. When you realize that intrinsic power in your own self, you also discover the integral ability to understand karma, cause and effect, and how at that moment you do realize that the happiness and sufferings of the others do depend upon your actions of body, speech, and mind. That awareness itself is one of the very important factors that allows compassion to not be a religious quality to cultivate, but a social responsibility that you have and you should, that you teach your children, and therefore you must cultivate in your own life. And so the second point of the mind training of Lojong basically is a very gradual step of trying to impart these two crucial points. One is, try it in contemplation until you're able to really engage in it. And the most important factor is, watch yourself able to exaggerate or not exaggerate a situation. The third point then talks about carrying adversities to the path of the practice. And I think in terms of cultivating compassion or any acts of compassion, whether it is kindness, whether it is love, whether it is generosity, of course it's in the given normal life, these are difficult things to do. You'll be upset, you'll be angry, you'll be stingy, you'll be arrogant, you'll be ignorant and lazy, and all kinds of different neuroses will come about. It's never really bad. Because in the moment of your not being able to be compassionate, if you can still bring about your awareness of watching yourself do this, you still are able to transform what is an appearance-wise negative action into a very acute wisdom ability of knowing yourself better. In the same way, a lot of the people who are practicing any kind of spirituality, Buddhism also, for whatever reasons it may be, although one really can't say why this happens, but somehow people have always today associated being spiritual with being sad, that it's almost a sin to be happy. For Buddhists, you can't be happy in your generosity and compassion because we immediately think, well, that's going to make it a concept. That's going to be dualistic. This is being arrogant. This is self-grasping. So we always avoid the enjoyment of the abilities of happiness. If we talk about subtle and gross self-grasping, yes, certainly it will be self-grasping. But at the moment where we are trying to practice compassion, it becomes essential to be kind to yourself, to know that to be a full bodhisattva or a bodhisattva or a Buddha who has no duality, no shades of any kind of self-grasping is a good idea. But let's leave it for the future. Right now, we do not have that ability. So be a little bit happy that you are able to be a little bit kind, little bit compassionate. Taking adversities have to be understood as being happy in your small accomplishments, but allowing it to not stagnate your progress, but be an inspiration to joyfully do more and better and more naturally. That is the way to transform something that has the full potential of being an adversity into the path of virtue. In the same way, when you do encounter moments where you feel very aggressive, when you feel very proud, when you feel very envious and jealous of the others, I would say, you know, you can't do much. I would love to say, don't feel it. But does it help? It wouldn't help at that moment unless you're really able to, you know, have a power of mind to transcend. Some of you maybe, but let's talk about ordinary people like ourselves who are not able to do it. Then I would say, feel the jealousy, feel angry, feel arrogant, feel desireful, feel lazy, keep it short. No. It's a feeling. Remember, from the second point you learn whether you're not going to exaggerate it. So if you don't exaggerate it, there is no one who's keeping accounts, you know, about how long you prolonged that feeling. A feeling is as big or as small as you want it to be. You can make it terribly bad and linger on it for years and years, or it can be this short span. Feel the jealousy, let it go, just as so many of our great masters have said, that's what you need to do. Being able to have an adversity, but through the adversity, also training yourself to be able to be a little bit more confident in going beyond things without allowing everything to be aggravated into this very state of stagnancy, which does not allow progress and development within oneself to happen. Which then gradually leads to, as the fifth point says, integrate the practices of Dhamma into daily life, which is very crucial. I think this is probably one of the most crucial things that the Western, and of course the Eastern also, but since we are talking the Western community or practitioners need to do is, you cannot practice Buddhism by being weekenders. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you're thoroughly inspired to practicing compassion. By Monday, you forget you're even a Buddhist. Doesn't work very well when it has to be brought into transcending of personality and attitude and conduct. Every moment one must practice. The way to actually practice compassion genuinely without it falling into the very old patterns of worldly dharmas, as we spoke about earlier, without compassion becoming embroiled in very mundane neurotic tendencies, it becomes important to practice it every day. It becomes necessary to allow genuine ethics of dharma, the genuine practices and the disciplines of dharma to be integrated in everyday life. One of the biggest challenges for people, as it is we say, to not find the Dharma in your life is a challenge itself. Then you find the Dharma and you practice the Dharma is another challenge. But these two challenges are nothing compared to not becoming religious about your Dharma. Now, being religious about your Dharma is where you take Dharma to be something that is a religious idea that you can believe in but not integrate. That would be becoming religious about Dharma. Buddhism is never taught that way. Buddhism has nothing. If you say you're not a Buddhist, there's no harm done at all. But when the harm is done is you know about Dharma and there is no personification of that in your attitude and in your conduct. And therefore, what you are learning in Dharma, whether it is about reducing self-grasping, whether it is about not lying, not harming others, letting go of anger, letting go of attachment, being more kind to the others, these are teachings that must be integrated in one's life completely. When you're doing it, it doesn't matter whether you call yourself a Buddhist or not. It really doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if you have no idea of history of Buddhism, East or West or Indian or Tibetan or wherever it is. If you have no idea of all the very profound philosophical ideas, you do not know who's who, you have no particular association with any particular lineage, it really doesn't matter. So long as there's a genuine development of one's attitude and conduct based on the fragrance and the wisdom of the teachings in one's own life. For example, would you like to sit, for example, because I travel a lot, so many of my examples are about traveling. So if you're traveling a lot, my question would be, would you rather sit with a very knowledgeable, obnoxious Buddhist or a very nice person? I go out of my ways to avoiding learned, obnoxious Buddhists who can talk about, dissect an atom into whatnot, isn't it? But then someone who is so full of one's own self. Now, when we hear such examples, we relate to them. But do we practice them? Because that person doesn't have to be the second person. It could be I. It could be each one of us. And therefore, thinking carefully that the whole purpose of our associating with this path of practice was never to become so learned about Buddhism, but to be able to take whatever little that we are able to learn into becoming better human beings. That is then called integrating Dharma in daily life. And at what point did we deviate from that path into becoming more clever people, more theoretical people, more scholastic people? That we don't know, but many of us do fall into that trap. When the daily integration of Dharma in life becomes not forced by methods and teachings, but becomes natural to you, especially brought about by the development of awareness and mindfulness, taught by your meditation and the blessings of one's teachers, then that is called cultivating the fifth point of one's Lojong training, and that is called being able to accomplish the standard of proficiency in daily life, where you become proficient, knowledgeable about awareness, knowing yourself better, being able to watch yourself better. And the watching and training yourself doesn't have anything to do with any religious ideas. You do not do it because of Buddhism. You do not do it because some teacher told you to do so. You do not do it because you adhere to a certain philosophy, but you realize that to be your own natural ability, that you're being compassionate not because of karma. You're not becoming compassionate in order to become a Buddha. You're not becoming compassionate to outshine other Sangha members, but that you're becoming compassionate because this is your natural ability and this is who you are as a human being. That is then being able to really gain proficiency in training one's own mind, in cultivating genuine compassion. Now, in the Lojong training, the sixth point contains or consists of, I think, 16 slogans, which is usually called the disciplines of mind training. And the seventh point of the Lojong training consists of another 21 slogans, which are called guidelines of mind training. Now, between these 21 and the 16 slogans, which I encourage everyone to really study, sometimes I think more than all the protection knots and things that we wear around our neck, it may be a better idea to keep those slogans close to our own hearts, is because those slogans, as simple as they are, somehow very directly teaches us how to actually practice genuine compassion by knowing that compassion is not one word. It's not one emotion. It's not one word. It's not one quality. But it is a composition of everything that we do physically, verbally, and mental thoughts, in the form of mental thoughts. When every action that we do precedes by an awareness of whether it can cause harm to self or the others, whether before we say anything, we are consciously aware, naturally adept at generating an awareness of whether this is going to harm somebody else, whether it is worth saying it, whether it's really necessary to say it at all, or could it be said in a way that would instill inspiration and happiness in the others. Whether when we are generating any kinds of thoughts, where there is an awareness, a pervasive mindfulness and an awareness which is able to think, is it really worthwhile? Is it really necessary? Is this good? Is this bad? When the wisdom of discernment arises in the form of a pervasive mindfulness, prior to every engagement of action arising from our body, speech, and mind, when that is able to be cultivated, such a person then is able to practice compassion more wholesomely, more completely. It no longer then becomes just an emotion. It no longer becomes just one thing to do or one quality, but it becomes the full personality. Such a personality is then known as someone who's engaged on the path of bodhisattva. And that is what we all aspire to do. This is the very gist of what the Lojong training or the teachings try to impart within our own selves. But with or without the Lojong trainings, by becoming a Buddhist or not being a Buddhist, what is very crucial is to cultivate this awareness of why spend so much time and energy and resources into a path of practice and contemplation if one is not able to recognize the inner responsibility of changing from within one's own self. Through reflection, knowing and understanding the power of your speech, the power of the actions of your body, the power of your thoughts that become the field upon which all actions of the three doors, body, speech, and mind, are generated. If that itself cannot be trained, then speaking about states of enlightenment and emptiness actually make no sense at all. In my young children's day, there are all kinds of nursery rhymes. It just occurred to me at the moment, you know. One talks about the cow jumped over the moon. There's something that says something like that, wasn't it? Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. Something about a cow jumped over the moon and the spoon was fiddling with a violin or something like that. And I don't remember it very well. But it just occurred to me, a nursery rhyme of impossibilities. The cow jumped over the moon. Sounds to me like meditating on emptiness and enlightenment, where the very nitty-gritty attitude and conduct of the person may be very stuck in self-cherishing, self-centeredness. And so where that self-centeredness and the self-cherishment itself is unable to really be eroded, shaken from its foundation, and made loose, and if possible, completely dismantled, such a person may then never really benefit from the teachings and the practices of Buddha Dharma. And so therefore, what can be done out of all this is a thorough self-examination. That's the way to go about it. Without self-examination, and again, knowing that I am speaking to the Westerners, self-examination often is considered to be self-critical, you know, being very critical to one's own self. As it has to be correctly understood. Self-criticism is good so long as that criticism makes you work harder in not making the same mistakes again. Otherwise, finding fault and being critical based upon your own self-examination has had no benefits. Every human being is endowed with the capacity to observe, to know very clearly. And when you clearly observe and know things that are embedded within one's own self that can be a cause of suffering to self and the others, wisdom is in not going back to that page again and to move on to progress, to development, and benefiting from all the subsequent teachers, teachings, practices that you have, to not having to go back to that kind of a state. And if you find yourself not having so many of these negativities, then to be absolutely happy, and in that joyfulness, gain the inspiration to do better and again, to be better and better. So that this existence of the human life that you have, and with an absolute potential to practice so much goodness in one's own self, is not thoroughly wasted, directing your practices and your association with the Buddha Dharma in a proper way, I think is most essential. Otherwise, it's been a long, interesting journey for all of us. And at the same time, if it doesn't result in bringing about benefit, then, you know, that's a real waste for self and for the others. So as much as possible, not getting into that waste, but training oneself into not being so much, again, a loyal Buddhist, but allowing the Buddhist teachings to bring about transformation, genuine change within one's own self, so that one is not spending time doing silly things, such as wanting to be the favorite of the teacher, isn't it? Or competing, you know, the silly things that we all get into. One retreatant in one room, the other retreatant in the other room rings the bell as loudly as possible just so that you can ring it louder than the other one. You're waking up at 3:30 in the morning because your roommate wakes up at 4 in the morning, isn't it? Or those various ideas of competition that we do bring in our own practice, where I think sometimes, you know, if we had an Olympics for enlightenment, that would still make some sense, isn't it? So that when you're prostrating and when you're vigorously, you know, rotating your malas with the many numbers and you say things like, I've done a million of that and I've done 1,000 of that and so on and so forth, that you do know you don't have a bronze medal to get. You don't have a record to break at all. But in some ways, it does seem like there is some kind of an Olympics of some kind of a competition. Especially, I think, the silly thing that we get into is the competition in terms of who can be closer or who can be better or who can be more accomplished as a meditator, as a practitioner. And those, I think, are the smaller sort of agendas of the self-cherishing that come in. And one may in that way become, in appearance, a very dedicated student of a teacher or a very dedicated practitioner or a good retreat and so forth. But as I normally like to call it, is people who don't necessarily have a thoroughly sort of a transformed mind. And so if you see them, supposing there are some people who have done many years of retreat that I know of, but if I see them coming towards me, I sometimes take a big U-turn, you know, to try and avoid. Now, why do we do that? It's because you've done the practices, but somehow the practices have all been on the outward level without it really transforming the mind. And so just as I said earlier, likewise, it could be one's own self, that you could slowly be cultivating enormous amount of practices on the external, But if the inner mind itself never changes, it is still full of self and self-absorption. And the key factor of sustained ignorance, the self-absorption, if that is continued, then heaps and heaps of teachings and practices and methods wouldn't bring about any real benefit for self and the others. So I encourage all of you, I encourage myself to try as much as possible to break free from such a pretentious connection to the Buddha Dharma. And through the generous kindness, wisdom, and love of all our teachers, that we may all have the courage to practice Dharma inwardly before expecting changes to happen on the external side. So with that, I keep the talk here and thank every one of you, encourage all of you to really work with the practices of bodhicitta, especially since we have talked about Lojong training, the Lojong training, which is very essential, and to see the path that you are working on as a path of really working with your own self, so that you do not become someone who wants to be the first one to attain enlightenment in the West, so that you can turn around and tell others how ignorant they were. So thank you, and then have a good night.